Sounds like it's working. Oh, it's too loud. Is it too loud back there, or is that good for you? Sounds louder than normal. See if I can find, audio level. Is that change? No, that's, microphone audio. Let's try now. Is that better? Nope, that's too weak. How about that? Better? Sounds good to me. If I can hear it, you probably can hear it. Let's see, they moved my old little clock there, so I have to do it on internal time. Who would take a little clock like that? Well, I've got a timer, so we'll wing it. So what I want to do to start out is talk a little bit about the project. And I realize that even though most of you have used Eclipse since last semester or previous classes or other work, you may not have used some of the version and options that I'm using, particularly the Makefile with Ant and build.xml. Also, it's the case you may not have gone ahead and done the option where you can import an entire project from a zip file. So I thought I'd walk you through that, both in terms of what you have to do and then actually on my Eclipse. So to start things off, and many of you have done this, but not all, is I give you a working program to start with. Now be careful, because the working program, as I'll show you, is not a solution to your problem. It's a solution to a related problem that would motivate you. And in fact, I saw some Piazza traffic earlier today saying, hey, wait a minute, when I run the test program in your startup, it's got an error. And in fact, it does. That's sloppiness. I didn't really intend it. But the point was, really, that was a program to test my program. And my program is simple enough, it doesn't really use scoping. So the fact that something's undeclared or out of scope is irrelevant to that. All this thing does is mechanically go through scopes and say, each place where I see a declaration, I'll count it. Each place I see a use, I'll count it. And whether it's illegal or illegal because of multiple declaration or no declaration or whatever, is irrelevant. It's that simple. Sometimes an analysis doesn't require a program to be perfect. It's got to be well-structured and have a valid tree. So read the Piazza, and you will have to fix that program if you decide to use it on your program to test it. And probably a week or two in, I'll fish out some of the tests I used on my solution and show you the data I used and the output I got, just so that you can check and see if you're getting what I was expecting. So let's switch over from this. So we're going to load project one. I'm assuming that you've gone ahead and on your favorite web browser found the assignment and decided to download the project1.zip and put it somewhere in your file system where you can retrieve it. So that being the case, what we're going to do is go into Eclipse, and let me now switch over to... Oh, wait a minute. It's not showing... I'm not showing my job. In fact, it's not showing my desktop at all. Okay. So let me, just when you think you got the silly thing running. Safari. Okay. So things. Oh, I've got. What did I do wrong?
I'm trying to get this.
I'm trying to get that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, it should be on there.
Something about Safari up here, and it should be showing Finder. And now, oops! Something. You did it, or I did it. Somebody.
I did that.
So what's that silly? So some... Maybe this thinks I'm in dual screen mode or something? I don't, but I may have tripped into it. I normally just use a single monitor.
Anybody own a Mac that uses dual monitors? I think you should be able to pull it over.
Yeah, I'm trying. Right. So it's... Excuse me?
Do you want to mirror them?
Sure. It's a good idea. Okay, that looks promising.
So,
I think this, well, I got problems. Oh, no, that's fine, yeah. Yeah, no, cool. I think that's what I wanted. Thank you. What was going wrong? What was I showing here?
You were extending the display instead of mirroring it. So if you wanted to show it on the other one, you'd have to drag this to the other window.
Okay, well, good. How many PhDs does it take to change a light bulb, right? So, as I was saying, what happened, this is essentially, should be Eclipse, and what I'm going to show you about the steps we go through there. So we go up to File, and in there we do Import. And that'll bring up something, and what we do is we then click General, and existing projects, because I'm taking a project and it already exists and we're just importing it into a new workspace. So we then do next. And what here is we select the archive file. And now what you'll do is you'll browse around to wherever it is you downloaded the zip file and have to find it. So I have mine. Come on, guy. Oops. Should be on the desktop. In a temp file. Yeah, CS 536 project 1 zip, I think it's there. And we finish. And I sometimes get this message, but it doesn't seem to really be a problem. So what I have here now in my listing of projects is the startup one. So this is the one that solves my problem, which is related to yours. So what makes this a little bit different is we're going to use something called ANT, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But an ANT is essentially a version of a build program. Now, most large operations use build. The original Unix was something called make, and there's legendary stories about make files. And I'm sure in your system in Windows, there's some sort of build process that says when you put together a product. It's not as simple as running a compiler on one source and getting an output file and using it. That's the simplified version, but in many cases, you have to run a series of programs. And particularly in our case, you'll not run just Java, but we'll also run a tool called JLEX. It generates a scanner. And then another tool called JavaCup that generates a parser. Now, these are Java programs, but they're not compilers for Java. They're compilers for specialized languages that describe a scanner or a parser. So we have to have some way of saying, oh, I just changed my description of my parser, rebuild the parser. What'll happen is it'll run cup. That will generate source in Java, and then it'll run a Java compiler and link in any libraries and things like that. So build is now more complex than it used to be. It's also the case that in many situations, after I build, I'll do a test, and you'll probably do that too, in that just changing a program is not enough. I'm not sure what the protocol here is, but in many operations, you have to do something called regression testing. And it's a situation there that one of the difficulties in fixing a problem is you can fix the problem, but damage something else. It's oftentimes the case that a simple fix screws up something else. So for major releases, you have something typically called a regression test that runs a whole multitude of tests and compares each one of them. Did you screw up this? Did you screw up that? Does this still work? Does that still work? Etc. And that's all part of the build process. And I don't know if any of you have been through the build, but sometimes those builds can take hours depending on how elaborate they are. So sometimes on some operations, they'll say, as of midnight tonight, we're fixed. We're now going to do a build of a whole new release, and come whenever it's done, that'll be the product. And don't change anything, don't screw up anything while we're building. So that's just a little flavor. You're not going to be anything that complex, but it's a little flavor of what you're going to do. So anyway, for build.xml, and I'm going to supply those to you so you don't have to write them. You probably want to look at them. In fact, let's go ahead and do it. It's essentially an XML, and XML is a tree-like language, and it has a series of things called targets. And a target is a step you want to get done. It turns out that Eclipse automates this, so you don't have to look at this too much, but you may have to look at it occasionally for very minor changes. Like if you change the name of a file, you may need to change the new name in this if it's talking about it. If I'm running a particular test and you want to run a different test, later on, as I promised you, I'd put a GUI in to make that easier. But what you have to do is find some point where it's doing a test. And let's see if I can find that. Probably went right past it. Yeah, here's test. And for example, here I have test.light and bigger test.light. And you might decide, oh, I want to have bigger still test.light. And you simply edit in the new name. A very routine sort of thing. And, you know, just use a conventional editor. So basically, that exists, but you won't have to do much changing, if any. And the way you utilize this is you right-click, and this brings up a whole series of things. You find run as, and you have two options, and take number two, which is the dot, dot, dot. And here you have a series of targets you can do. You can do a single one, in which case it'll do it, or you can do a series. So what I'll illustrate is clean. Clean is one you typically do at the beginning. It cleans up all the old stuff. So if you've done substantial changes and you're getting something strange, throw away all the old compilations and start fresh. Compile, as the name suggests, and test. And what down here is it shows you the order. Order can be important. And in fact, in this case, the order is the ordering on this list. And what we really want is to do the clean first, then the compile, then the test. So what we do is we activate order. By the way, you only have to do this once, so it's no big deal. And we'll find clean, and we'll move them up. If you don't like this, you can simply do one step at a time, and then, having done the first step, do the second and the third. So we say, okay. So I'm going to do a clean, a compile, and a test. Then let's see if it does what it should. And what's going to have down here on the console, yeah, let me extend this up. So you should get something that looks like this, and you can scroll this, of course. And first, what it did, and let me extend the program side a little bit. So in this case, it did the clean, which essentially just thrown stuff away. Then it did compiles, and then it did a couple of tests. And what it does is essentially does something called unparsing. Unparsing simply says, takes the tree and gives you a linearization of it that should conform to the source. That's really just a sanity check, is the tree sound or not? So in this case, I'm just doing it so you can look at the program. And this is the program that was analyzed. And again, it's pretty printed a little bit. That means it's put in a format that I like rather than necessarily the format you supplied. Remember, format is lost when you go ahead and compile because all that really matters is the structure and the symbols, not where they're laid out. So in this case, here's the source and there's the analysis and then a second one and a more complex analysis. And I hope it's correct. And there's a little file here called expected output that you could compare against. So, you know, if you aren't sure whether your program ran or not. So this is just to get my program into your environment, and now you're all ready to test it. Now, it turns out in office hours, a couple of students came in, actually three, and they all had a problem having to do with running Eclipse on Windows using Ant. And I think we got that fixed. I dug out an old problem. We put it up on Piazza. But it's essentially, I think, a tension between what Windows does. And Windows, of course, is Microsoft, so they do anything they darn well please. And what Eclipse wanted. And essentially, some environment variable was set one way in Windows and set a different way in Eclipse. And what you had to do is change it. So I put the message out there. If you're getting that, you should only be getting it if you're running on Windows. I'm not sure if it's on all Windows or just some. But if three people had it yesterday, more may have had it. And there's a little fix for it. It's no big deal. It's simply Windows decided to set the variable one way. Eclipse expects it to be a little different. And as all you all know in programming, a little difference can make a big problem. So I've seen it in the past. We got it fixed. If you're running Macs, you won't have a problem. And I didn't even notice it on mine because I'm running a Mac. also if you're running Linux, but I don't think many of you are, to university, many of the university machines run Linux, and that does not have the problem either. It's just Windows deciding to do it their way. And I think the setup was Windows sets up Java expecting it'll only be used to run existing Java programs. Eclipse, of course, is set up to let you create brand new Java programs, and therefore the setting it wanted was a little bit different. It's no big deal, but it's something where you won't make much progress until you get that fixed. So let's go back here. So let me talk a little bit about ANT. That's that build.xml stuff I showed you. So ANT is just a build tool. And again, if you've ever heard of a famous program called Make, it's a variation on that. It's in Java, and it's more platform independent. Make was Unix, and Make files were, again, they're very, very widely used. There's some extremely complex Make files out there that just run. And it's one of those things there, if they run, you don't mess with them because even a little change may mess them up. So, again, we're going to use it because after the first couple of stages, in fact, after this first project, you're going to have to build scanners, build parsers. You're going to use something called Jasmine, which I'll show a little more about, that actually runs an assembler that takes JVM code in symbolic form and puts it into the .class format that the Java runtime system expects. So all these tools exist. But it turns out that Eclipse by itself doesn't know about these guys. Eclipse handles Java. Doesn't know anything about scanners or parsers or JVMs until we tell it about it. And the way we tell it about it is by saying, here's a build that'll tell you, here's how to build a scanner. And one of the things you do in a scanner is run JLEX. Here's how you build a parser. One of the things you do is run JavaCup. But a parser expects a scanner. So the JavaCup will also run the scanner if needed to make sure it's got a scanner. And it goes through on the various phases. It should run pretty much automatically, but we need to use that tool, and that's why it's there. You don't have to use ANT exclusively inside Eclipse. If you're just doing Java and Java C in some environment where you have a compiler available, you should probably have ANT also loaded. ANT is just an acronym, and it stands for another neat tool. Some acronyms are cool and some are pretty stupid, and this lands in a pretty stupid bunch, but naming is kind of hard. Do you have here anybody in a group that actually does nothing else but name products? Turns out, there are some groups, where getting the name is absolutely important. There's an old story, I don't know how true it is, they say it's one of these urban legend type things, that years ago there's a car done by, I think it was by Chevy, by GM, called the Nova. And again, what happens is that makes sense because Nova in Latin, I think, means new. And of course, Nova in English commonly uses a star, a new star. But of course, Chevy tries to sell its products throughout the world. And the story was they were sending it to Mexico, Central America, and South America, where Spanish, of course, is the dominant language, excluding Brazil. And I'm not sure if this is true in Brazilian or Portuguese or not. But I'm getting some mail. I hope not showing. Okay, good. So it turns out that apparently in Spanish, and I don't speak Spanish, but Nova means doesn't run or doesn't go. Is that correct for people who know Spanish? Doesn't go. So you can imagine how much you're selling a car. It's like coming up a car here and selling a car named the Lemon or the Loser or the Rambling Wreck or whatever it happens to be. So, it turns out you have to be careful. And another example is when I was growing up, Chevy's used to have a little thing on the cars called Body by Fisher. I said, hey, this is cool. Fisher finally did something other than get sent to jail, and that was pretty good. And they decided to sell these things in Germany. But of course, you wouldn't say Body by Fisher in Germany because it's English. But it turns out somebody made a slight mistake because the word body actually has two German cognates. One means body, like human body, and that's Körper. But there's also another meaning for body, like what happens when you go to a funeral parlor, and that's called Leiche. And, of course, somebody screwed it up, so they translated Body by Fisher to Corpse by Fisher. So you can imagine you're going into a car and you say, here's a brand new car made in America, and the corpse, somebody's corpse, was designed by the Fisher people. So turns out you got to be careful, and ANT, I don't think, is a great name, but at least it's not obscene, and it's not going to... not going to hurt too many. But the point of this is then, if you have ANT installed, and if you have Java and Java C installed, and for some reason you don't want to use Eclipse or you have other systems, You can either run ant as a standalone by simply saying ant and the target or a list of targets. So if you have ant installed, you can say ant compile, and it'll go ahead and find your make file by going to build.xml and run the steps. So you don't have to be in Eclipse, although that's what I'm assuming most of you will do. So that's just a little bit over there. And having said that, here's the step I showed you where we right-click on build.xml and do that. But it turns out I said all these steps that we were doing were something you wouldn't have to do all the time. Up here and on my system, it doesn't come out very well, but there's a little thing up top that's a symbol, and I think it has a little suitcase symbol on it. And I believe that's the run. And you notice what it said down here is that it's going to run the project build.xml. So once you've got the build and the target set up the way you want, you just have to click this guy, which is way easier, and it'll redo that step. So in many cases, you'll be running a project. You simply want it to build a scanner or build a parser and test it. So you make some changes, run it and test it, make some changes, run it and test it, and all you have to end up doing then is click that little guy, and it'll activate the build. So these steps I showed you are necessary to set it up. But once you're there, then this thing's a way easier way to do it. So let's go to the assignment we were talking about. And some people were in yesterday, and I'm sure I'll see more as the week goes on. So what we did, is gave you a working solution to a simpler problem. But to the point is it does one of the major things exactly the same as you'll do, and that's namely walk the abstract syntax tree. And I'll get into details of that in a moment. So what this thing did, and the example that I just ran would show you, is it takes a program, and as I mentioned earlier, it should be a valid program in terms of scoping, but it doesn't need to be, actually, because this doesn't know about scoping. You will. That's one of the things you'll have to add. But all it does is, each time it sees a new scope, how does it know it's a new scope? Well, syntactically, that's a left brace that either opens the main program or opens a block. And each scope has a line number. As I'll show you, you get the line number right from the abstract syntax tree that's given to you. So the line number's sitting there, you just grab it. And then you simply go ahead, and each time you see a declaration, and you know it's a declaration because you're in the subtree called var decl node for variable declaration. Other places you'll see identifiers as uses, like in an expression or in an assignment. A couple of other places, you count uses, and then you generate this listing. Another issue I had in talking about this is you'll have to do a lot of work on the abstract syntax tree, and I'll get to that in just a bit. But in the abstract syntax tree, there's some construct you may not know much about. I didn't talk much about it at all in 367, and 302 may or may not have. I wasn't here, so I'm not positive. But there are certain classes called abstract. As the name suggests, abstract classes don't really exist. They're simply placeholders. And they're used essentially to say, in the place where this abstract class is expected, I'm going to find one of this abstract class's children. So we'll create abstract classes where I know I need some kind of construct, but I don't want to specify exactly which one. What does that mean? Well, there'll be an abstract class called a statement node, abbreviated STMT. A statement node says, here's a spot where I'll have a tree for a statement. Which one? Well, I don't know. There's many statements. There's an assignment statement. There's an if statement. There's a while statement. There's a call statement, etc. But I need a statement. I won't accept something that's not a statement. So if you put in the spot of a statement a method declaration or a variable declaration or a single identifier that's an expression, it'll say, no, 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 no. I can't have that because these things are not subclasses of a statement. So what statement does essentially allow you to break the tree down into groupings of things like declarations, expression components, and statements, and say I'll take any of the one class, but I won't take the other classes. So that's how we use the abstract classes. So the thing to remember, if you see an abstract class, it's going to have children. And in fact, on the assignment, I list out the abstract classes and their children. And when you see the abstract class, in reality, you'll see one of the children. And one of the nice things about abstract classes is you can put shared identifiers, shared declarations in the abstract class as saying that all children will automatically get those. And I'll show you that in a minute. Something else I'll do that looks a little odd, but I kind of led up to it in 367, was that trees are linked together by using references. The trouble about using references may be null. If you try to use a null reference in runtime, Java is very strict. It kills you. It essentially says error, you know, illegal use of reference, and terminates your program. So what you did when you did 367 is you were very careful if you were programming properly and always saying, are you null? If so, do this. Are you not null? Then do that. And the more references you use, the nastier that gets, and it's boring. Are you good or are you bad? Mother, may I or may I, may not? Like simple, what is it, simple Simon? Or what is it, Simon says, right? May I? Simon says, and if I don't say Simon says, you're not supposed to do it. Same sort of thing here. So the fix I have in this context doesn't work necessarily in all, but I think it works beautifully here, is that in an abstract syntax tree, there are no null references to tree nodes. Where you say, how can that possibly be? What I do is where you might otherwise have had a null reference, I create an honest-to-gosh node that's a null node of some variety. It might be a null statement, a null declaration, a null label, whatever. And it's got nothing in it, but it's a real honest-to-gosh node. And therefore, visiting it and using it is not illegal. Typically, all you do is you visit it, it's empty, so nothing happens, and you return. But the cool part is you now don't have to check when you say, oh, a tree's got three children. It will, in fact, have three subnodes. Some of them may be null, some of them may not be, but it's safe to visit them without saying, mother, may I, because those nodes will exist. So if you're looking around and saying, why does he have all these crazy null nodes? I'm doing a trade-off. And I think it's a good trade-off is I have no null references, but there are spots where I have an option and don't use them. So I may, for example, have a loop that has optionally a label, but most loops don't. So I can have a subtree that says either I'm the null node or I'm an honest-to-gosh identifier being used as a label. But the link will always be there. So I just wanted to point that out to you. Why am I doing that? It's just the design decision I made. I think it's a good one because it makes most of your code simpler. As you say, if I got three children, I'll visit all of them if I care to. They'll always be there. And of course, if they're null nodes, the null nodes will have no children. So you still don't get into an infinite traversal. The thing does stop. You're saying, well, gosh, isn't he wasting a little bit of space? And all I'll say is this guy's got plenty of space, right? This guy's got 8 gigabytes of main memory. A couple of bytes here and a couple of bytes there doesn't mean anything. It's one of these false economies that at some stage you have to get away from. Keeping a program as idiot-proof as you can make it is good. And one of the ways you make it idiot-proof is you don't do stupid things like try to follow null reference. If there are no null references. Now remember, there's still going to be null references in other part of the compiler. I'm simply saying in the AST. Inside other data structures, like, for example, you may have a hash table, which I'll talk about. You may have null references there. That's something separate. But inside the tree, because it's so complex potentially and so extensive, I wanted to have this simple rule. So I thought I'd set that out for you and explain why I did it and just make you aware of what's going on. So having done that, and by the way, all these notes that I'm showing are available. You can print them out. Some of you may have. In terms of the class webpage, I have an L2 for Lecture 2 supplemental. And what I did is yesterday, I scanned all these and put them online. So if you copied out your supplemental notes over the weekend, you got an older, out-of-date one. I decided I had a little time, and I didn't feel like doing any real work, so I just created notes instead. Real work at the university is usually doing things like paperwork, writing letters of recommendation or writing reports or gosh knows what. So let me show you then from these. What I did is I printed out a couple of the classes, and what I did is I wrote in Yeller what was important. And again, I'm not sure if you have a color printer, that's cool. It'll come out nice because these are copied in color. I'm not sure if these, has anybody tried to print these out in black and white? Do they come out well? After the fact, I thought yellow is great in color, but in black and white, it's not. So if this isn't quite as visible as it should be, you may have to print it out and add your own marker, you know, kind of like paint by numbers or something. So this is P1, and that's where everything starts. What happens is project 1 starts at P1, project 2 will start at P2, etc. There's a lot of stuff there that we're giving you that essentially does some of the stuff, and you're welcome to read it just to get a sense, but it's actually doing the scanner and parser steps for you because you're not up to it yet. We haven't talked about scanning and parsing. So to stuff is all fine. And the only thing near the very bottom where I have it marked in yellow is down here, we're building a parse tree. Of course, it's got a root. So root.value is a link to the actual AST node. And it's typecast as CSX light node because the root has to be a light node. So it's a way of saying the root is going to be a light node, and please go ahead and follow it. And what I'm doing is calling count decals and uses. You're going to change that. You're going to change that to your solution, which is the identifier cross-reference problem. Now, somebody asked me yesterday, could I simply take the code in here and change it? That is, temporarily let it still be count decals and uses and reprogram it. And the answer is yes, because almost every place where I call count decals and uses, you'll count your routine. In fact, after you do that, this might be a good spot to do that refactoring I talked about, where you can systematically change the name. So you can either write another method that kind of is collateral with it. Every time there's a count decals and uses, there'll be one of yours also. Or you can simply take mine and change them. But of course, there the problem is always in changing things. At some point, you may have things half changed and half not changed, and that doesn't always work all that well. So just programming style, yes, you can do it, but be careful. If you bring in your own classes, well then, you know, they just parallel. So at this stage, you're going to have your implementation of count decals and uses, probably has a different name. Probably you should do that for the grader, if nothing else. So poor grader is going to be confused if he sees count decals and uses and doesn't realize it's your recoding. But in terms of using it as a shell, as a placeholder, that's perfectly okay. So there's also another data structure that I'm going to use. And this is something I call scope info. Now, here's something you're going to have to change, because what I'm doing is I'm creating information about scopes. And let me just go back if I can find that sucker again. Yeah. So remember, I was collecting information about scopes. So each time you see on my printout a scope, what you're really seeing is a toString applied to one of these scope info guys. You're going to, again, you can either change this or create a similar but differently named data structure that would essentially represent one entry per identifier. And what this identifier is actually going to be in our first single step is the entry in a block structured symbol table. So remember, for scopes, what did I require? I required, that I give it a number, number one, number two, and so on. So that's an int. A line number, I get that from the AST. It said, where was this block or where was this program started? Typically, it starts at line one, but doesn't have to. Because remember, I may have comments, which eat up some lines until I get to the actual program. That's legal, probably good programming style, so it's not guaranteed one way or the other. I then have an integer that counts the number of decals, the number of uses, and because I'm going to have a number of scopes, what I do is simply have a link. Now, what you could have done is, now that you're all good 367 students, is simply have a list of scope infos. I did not code it that way. I'm an old school kind of guy that actually creates link pointers and links them together. That's probably just, you learn it one way, it kind of sticks with you. But this is really just a list a la what we talked about in 367. And what will happen is, when you're all done, you'll have a data structure that's a list with as many entries as I had scopes. And each one of them will have information about the number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, blah, blah, where it was, the number of declarations, the number of uses, and voila. Notice that's exactly the info you need to print this out. So this is simply, on a line-by-line basis, a toString applied to that data structure. Scope 1 is the number, starting at 1. The line number is whatever it was. The count of decals was whatever it was. The count of uses was whatever it was. And, of course, the constructor sets the initial values appropriately. So you're going to need a data structure that you accumulate. Now, in your case, as I said, it's not going to be scopes. It's going to be, rather, individual declarations. Let me see if I can find that assignment. By the way, I brought along extra assignments. I passed it out last time. I should have handed them about a bit ago. Does anybody need one of these assignments since I'm talking about it? I passed it out. You may have printed it or you may have it on string, but I got some printed in case anybody wants one. Yeah. Anybody else? So the reason I wanted to bring that to your attention is let's compare what I had here with the data structure that you're going to generate. So I have one in hand here. And what's going to happen is this is a little different because notice now I'm not having a list of scopes. I'm having a list of declarations. And the number of items in this list will be exactly equal to the number of, the number of declarations in the program. So in this case, I clearly had two declarations, and therefore I have two entries. If I had 10 declarations, I'd have 10 entries, and see if I have a more complex one deeper in. Yeah, no, this is the main one. So what you're going to do is, as you walk the tree, you're not going to build a list of scope info nodes. You build a list of something, and you might call them ID decl info or ID info or whatever name you consider appropriate. But something that says, I'm going to have one of these guys per declaration. What am I going to have in there? Well, I'm going to have a line number. I can get that out of the AST just as I did for scopes. I'm going to have a name. That's clearly the name in the declaration. I'm going to have a type. There's a subtree in the declaration that says I'm an int type node or I'm a bool type node, and you can simply check those nodes. One way to do it is simply say, are you an instance of this or that? Alternatively, you can add a toString method to the node that says, by the way, if I want this node to be converted to a string, for an int type node, give me int. For a bool type node, give me bool, B-O-O-L, and just have it to have the toString do that conversion for you. But by the time you get here, this is a string. And what this is simply a list of length zero or more of all the line numbers in which this identifier was used. Now, one of the things we're going to need, and I'll talk about that as one of my first lecture items, is we're going to need a block structured symbol table. So besides changing from scopes to identifiers, you're going to have a block structured symbol table. And guess what? The symbol table is going to map identifiers to these entries. So eventually I'll have a symbol table. And let's say that's got an entry A. Remember, symbol tables have a key and a value. In many cases, the key for a symbol table is a string. Will be in our case. So you say, I'll have a symbol table entry for A that points me to that data structure that I just linked together. Why is that? Well, that has the fact that I am, in fact, A, and here's the list of all my uses. So later on, when, for example, down here, I see a use of A, I say, well, which declaration is appropriate? I go into the symbol table. In this case, they have only one scope, so the symbol table is real easy. I look them up and say, hey, here's A. The data structure that describes A, the symbol table entry, is this sucker. And what I'll do is say, well, I'm on line 4, so I'm going to add an entry to his list of uses at the end, I assume, because I want these in probably in ascending numeric order, that there was a use on line 4. Since there were two uses, I did this abbreviation to 4 with a repetition factor of 2. That's purely me printing them out in a nice way that I liked. If you wanted to, you could print this out as 4, 4, and that's perfectly fine. It's just like if you look at the back of a book with cross-references, they'll have a declaration point and then all the pages where it's used. And sometimes if it's used more than once, it shows the repetition, if that's important. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. So having talked about that, the last class I want to show you, this is the Java type class, is AST. And AST is where you're going to do almost all your work. Yeah, question? No, that's a cool thing. What happens is, that's a good point, is you'll have multiple entries. What happens is, that's a fair point, so let me do it here since I was doing it. Suppose down here, I just added in a new scope here, int A again, blah, blah. Just int A, semicolon. And that's at line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So what you'd have down here is 5, colon A, int, and all the places where it's used. So it's perfectly legal, because you can have declarations in different scopes to have two different lines at two different points that have the same name and may or may not have different types. and they'll have different use points depending on scoping. Where this guy is used won't be the same as where the earlier A was used. So it comes out really cleanly. Other questions on that? Okay, so what I want to do now is, again, the AST is fairly large. Not really, but 400 lines. But much of it is going to be unchanged. It's simply because the AST is so central. It's got a lot of stuff added in it, much of which you're going to come to appreciate in future. But it's one of these things, if it isn't appropriate to your particular assignment, leave it alone, please. So we start out with this abstract class AST node. And this is an abstract class. It's the parent of all abstract syntax tree nodes. And it has a couple of fields that I promised you, namely something called line number and column number. And this column and int running together, I think, is just an artifact of how it's printed out. This is valid Java. So all AST nodes will have a line number and a column number, which will be set up by the scanner and parser. And the purpose of it is for any error messages, or in this case, for analyses. So where did the line number come from? The scanner and parser set it up when they were doing their job, and it's sitting in the tree by the time you take over. So it's just there. And since it's in the parent class, if you're in any old class at all, you can say class name, no, for the instance of it, dot, line num or column num, and you have that data. So it's already there, guaranteed. So I thought I'd mention that. And what I've done is, and you may want to do something too, is that it's common to put in a default declaration for a method in the parent with the notion that if you choose not to override it, it'll take the default. And the default here is essentially do nothing. So in this case, count decals and uses takes scopes and returns nothing. Now, what your routine would do is you wouldn't have a scope info. You'd probably have something, as I said, something like ID info or whatever you might choose to call it. You're also going to have that block structured symbol table, and you can either pass that as an additional parameter or share it throughout the tree, because typically the symbol table will grow and shrink. But at any given point, there's really only one block structured symbol table in use, and it simply is added to when you make a declaration and diminished when you close the scope. So instead of passing as a parameter, if you wish, you may simply make it available throughout the entire abstract syntax tree. And one way to do that is inside the parent class, make yourself a static field. Remember, a static field is one that occurs only once in the entire class, not in every instance. So it's going to be shared by everyone. You make it static, and in that particular case, you're then able to use it. Remember, so you have instance, and you also have static. Instance methods and static methods, instant fields and static fields. So that's a way of doing it. So you'll have to make the symbol table available to all the methods. Either give it a name inside the parent class, and there's only one of them that's shared, or if you prefer to make an explicit parameter, that's fine too. You'd say, okay, Mr. Subtree, I want you to analyze this tree, and here's the symbol table, block structure symbol table I want you to use. And of course, that will change as you walk down the tree. It'll grow or shrink depending on what declarations have been processed. Both of them are perfectly fine solutions. You have to do one or the other. Do whichever you think is more tasteful or just feels better to you. But they're both quite workable. So now what happens is, let's go ahead and find the starting point for all this, and that's the root. So up here on line 70, this is actually part of the CSX Lite node. So it actually changed page. So up in the CSS Lite node, here's that thing I called from P1. And what it is something called count decals and uses. But it's a little different because it has no parameters. Why? Well, the AST is kind of an implicit parameter that I'm calling it. But what it's saying is the user doesn't know anything about these parameters I was talking about, ID info and symbol tables and all that. The user simply wants data. So it says, here's a tree, and please give me this nice listing of scopes or declarations and uses of identifiers. And here's how I set it up. You'll have to do something similar. First of all, I have to have a scope list. Where did it come from? I have to create it. So the first thing I do is create myself a brand new scope list. And what I do there, it's number one in the list, and its line number is whatever it is, and the other things are defaulted to zero or null. So this creates me a brand new singleton scope, because at the start, all I have is a global scope. These two are recursive calls. It says, in this particular case, I have two children, and let's go back and look at those. Right here, yeah. So here it is. So the CSX Light Node, remember, has two children. One of them is called Prague Decals. That's for all the declarations. And the other is called Prague Statements. It also has the scope list information in there. Remember, that's that field that I just created. I want to make sure I have a place to store it. So I have two subtrees. And what this guy is doing right here is recursively walking the entire AST. I'm the root of the entire tree. So up here, the entire tree is really just two subtrees. One is for decals, and others is for the body, which are statements. So this is actually doing everything. But of course, what happens is the trees have subtrees, and they work it on down. So what you'll have to do is something very similar, but you're not counting decals and uses. Rather, you're doing this analysis for the counting and the cross-references for identifiers. And then finally, when I'm all done, I build up an entire scope list for the main scope and all the remaining scopes. How did it happen? Well, the scope list that I'm passing in right here as a parameter is a list. And the subtrees added information to it as it saw a new sublist, new subtrees that represent scopes. So when I'm all done, the scope list has all the scopes that ever exist in the program. And I say, well, wait a minute. The user doesn't want to see a data structure. They want to see actual characters that a human can read. So I simply call toString. That walks the data structure, putting it in that pretty format that I showed you, and that's returned to the caller. So the call starts here, and it ends there. But what then happens is I have to go through the tree, finding all the spots where declarations might occur and all the spots where statements might occur, and make sure I can connect a tree. So what I did is I went through and I marked in yellow all the spots where I found a non-trivial count decals and uses. So, for example, here's one of them called field decals. Now, what I do in my tree is I use a plural S when I have a list of things and a singleton when I have just one. So I might have, in this case, a field decals node, and that represents all the field decals that exist. Inside there is a single field decal. That represents one field declaration, and the remaining declarations are decals. So remember, one way you can use a tree is as a crude linked list. And the way you do that is by essentially having a root that has one item and a subtree that has all the remaining items in two and three and so on. So I can use a list, I can use a tree to represent a list. And in this case, that's all I do. I don't know how many declarations I have, so I process number one, then number two, number three, et cetera, until I'm all done. So this shows that. How do I process a tree for counting decals? Well, I say the first field, which is called this field, might have some information in it, for example, a real declaration. So I'll go ahead and call it. I might have remaining fields, so I better call it. So it's essentially visiting this subtree and then that subtree. And that's how it works its way down the subtrees for declarations. Okay, here's the next one. Let's see, nothing here. Here's a case where, remember I talked about those null nodes on line 204. I just wanted to show you that if I have a null node, what I typically do there is simply have a method that does nothing at all, simply returns. So I put one in there in this case just to make explicit what I wanted done in a null node. But it's pretty much what you'd expect. Here's a cognate for decals called statements with an S. And it has a single statement followed by optionally additional statements. And the way I process it is by processing the first statement and then visiting the subtree for any remaining statements. So I can have as many declarations as I care to, as many statements as I care to. Here's an example of a null statements node, and it does nothing. Here's something that's interesting as things are going to get at least, is I have an assignment node. Remember, an assignment node is simply A gets expr in AST form. So how do I process that? Well, let's go down here. Notice in this particular case, I know for a fact in this simple language, the left-hand side is always a variable. I don't have anything as complex yet as subscripted variables, arrays. So I know there's at least one variable being used. So right here, I increment the count by one because I'm guaranteed there was one use right there. But the expression may have literals in there or they may have other variables in there. So I essentially then call the other subtree, which is called the source, and it will possibly find other identifiers. So if I add A gets A plus 1, tree-wise, that would be A plus A and 1. So I find the 1A here, and when I traverse this, as I'll show you in a moment, I would find the other A. But I'm walking the entire tree, and whenever I find an identifier, I process that guy. See, continuing on, a few more. Yeah, here's a binary operation node that represents a binary operator like plus or minus. It's got two subtrees, left operand and right operand, and I visit each of those to make sure I get all the identifiers in the left subtree, the right subtree. The identifier node represents a single identifier, so that's a use. Excuse me? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, there we go. And one that I think I skipped over, but I want to go back to, is finding the declarations. Sorry about that. I skipped over this one. This is one of the most ones. There's a node in there called a var decl node. This is used for variable declarations. It's got three components, the name, the type, and the initial value, which is always guaranteed to be null in this simple sublanguage. So a variable name is an identifier. Here's where you get the type. For remember, you got to get the information about the name and the type. The variable type is either going to be an int type node or a bool type node, and you have to visit one or the other and say, which are you, and get the information. But the important point is, in this case, you have a declaration. So in my count, I could take the declarations component and increment it by one. If I had a richer language that allowed initialization, I might have some uses. But in this language, I never have a use of an identifier in a declaration. Essentially, the declaration is either int A, something like that, or bool B. And surely I have one declaration, but I don't have any uses. So that makes that simple. So in through this, every place where I have yellow marked, you're going to have to figure out and say, well, I've got to do something similar, but respect to now not just scope counts, but rather, where was this identifier found? Is it a declaration? If so, I create this line that says the number, line number, the name, the type, and a list of uses. If it's a use, I go into my block structured symbol table, which I'll be talking about shortly, find the declaration corresponding to it, and increment the use list for that particular entry. And I think that's an overview of the changes I have in mind for you doing. And that was just more or less to orient you and get you started, since we're a week into the class and the thing is due in a couple of weeks. It's not really a hard problem, but it's one of those things, like anything, if you wait too long to start thinking about it, you may come up with something and get stuck. So any questions on the project in terms of what it is I'm expecting you to do? Certainly not as hard as it looks. And one thing I don't want people to be scared of is you look at the assignment and you say, oh my gosh, that thing's 8 pages long. Turns out assignments that have many pages are oftentimes better than ones that are short. You probably remember back when you were in school, there'd be some prof who'd give you a question on an exam or an assignment that was one or two sentences long. You know, explain how the lack of Weibelfitzers accelerated the fall of the Roman Empire. And you say, oh my God, you know, yeah, you want me to do that? And of course, they meant you to do lots and lots and lots of research. What I've done here is do some of the research for you. For example, tables drawn out of the code saying, here are the fields, here's what they're meant for, etc. So in this case, it's meant to give you a simple start. But that having been said, it seems simple to me. It may not seem quite so simple to you. So any questions at this stage about No, what's different, what's the same, what did I gloss over, except for block structured symbol tables, which I'll be getting to as my first lecture item. I will. Right. A couple of them I will. But this is one of them is really where, as long as the thing's syntactically valid, you can pretty much just do it. I mean, it's just a matter of going through there and counting. Oh, yeah. No, I'll put one out there. I'll put it out there. Yeah, and perhaps keep the format close. I'm sure our TA is going to try to automate the grading as far as possible. So usually what happens in these classes, we'll run a standard set of tests and try them. And be careful because we may try corner cases. So, for example, you have an array. I like to use linked list arrays because they're very flexible in size. You can say, well, no sane person would ever have more than 100 declarations. Whoever said the TA is sane, he may have tried 10,000. With a text editor, that's real easy to do. Or the other end, for example, is this a legal program in CSX? Open brace, close brace. Turns out it is. We mentioned that in the document. And you can probably have a pretty good bet that if the TA read that, he's going to try it. I mean, this is one of those corner cases, but a program that has nothing in it is still a program. You're going to get out something, an empty list probably, but the thing should not crash. And I've had people crash and say, well, golly, it's got to have something in it, and therefore it's going to initialize something down deeper, some silly thing like that. So be careful about that. You may try extreme cases and so on. Or you may try an expression that has 100 operands in it. But of course, that doesn't bother you because it's already converted to a tree. So a tree doesn't have 100 operands in it. It has two subtrees, which have two subtrees, which have two subtrees, and so on and so forth, which makes life easier. Any other questions? Okay, good. Let me go over then and spend most of the first hour, but let's get ourselves started in. Oh, got to change you over. Now let's hope this guy works. Come on. Okay, good. So we're officially starting lecture two, only an hour late or so on, but I hope the information I showed was useful. So we have a small reading assignment. After I get done talking about block structure symbol tables, I'll start aiming towards the second assignment already, which is already out, and that's generating a scanner. The difference for that one is you're going to have to learn some new concepts, some new terminology, and learn to use this new tool called JLEX. And what JLEX is a whole new language. And one of the things I'll talk about is, you may not have realized it, but our language is just an ordinary English. It's really lacking in that. In fact, I can talk a little bit about that now. One of the odd things about what we've learned in school, at least what I learned in school, is that we have tons of notations for numbers. And you remember that even if you're not into mathematics, remember you'd have e to the I and the cube root of x sub I to the n squared and things like that. You'd even come up with things like the square root of minus 1, which is oftentimes considered I, it's abbreviated I. I remember I had the great pleasure when I was going to college of living at home. So for me, college was 4 more years of high school, and boy, did I love that. And my father understood it was a good idea for me to get an education, but he wanted his money's worth. So a lot of times he'd ask me, what did you learn in school today? I remember one time I told him we learned about imaginary numbers. Well, no, why is it an imaginary number? Well, the square root of minus 1 cannot exist. Although there's lots and lots of mathematics, particularly if you're engineering, they use that. So I said, we learned about imaginary numbers. And he really blew his stack. I'm working hard. You're spending your school, all this money and all this, and you're learning about imaginary things. And I tried, this is mathematics. It's really very useful. So mathematics has gone so far that most of you who aren't mathematicians at least heard of imaginary numbers. But here's the odd thing, and I'll get to in scanning, is we have no similar notation for something that's at least as common as numbers. And that turns out to be strings. For example, how do I write down formally that I want you to find me words that have the final this property? And I'll draw it out because we don't have notation yet. It begins with a P, it ends with a T, and it has three letters in between. Now, why would I use that? Well, notice one of the things I'm doing, if I'm into crossword puzzles, I might want to have a program that allows me to do crossword puzzle cheating. In fact, they exist, programs like this exist, and does anybody know, any crossword puzzle people, are there apps that essentially allow you to do that? You know, give me, you know, something that fits this format. But even so, this makes more sense, because one of the things you're doing, almost certainly, is having applications that are set for tablets or for smartphones. And both of those have the ability, oh, there's a limit, so let me finish that. So they have the ability there to allow people to put stuff handwriting-wise in. So you may very well have an app that allows a physician or a nurse to put some sort of, got to really tap that sucker. So you might have some sort of notation that allows a doctor or nurse to write in some action they want done. But if you ever looked at how these things are doing, the more advanced a doctor is, the worse his or her handwriting is. So you can imagine that you have an application where the guy's written something down, and you're pretty sure the first letter is P and the last letter is T, and you want to search through common medical terms, for example, or maybe medicine names or actions, to see, is there anything I could guess? And you've probably seen that a lot of applications do that now. As you're typing along, if you don't type around quite right, it makes a guess and says, did you really mean this? And allows you to then do that. And you know, again, it's getting to be a fairly common sort of approach. But we don't have a notation until later in today's lectures to really write down something that says, I want to define something that has this flavor. It begins with this, ends with this, and has exactly three don't cares. Or probably it's not a don't care, because it's still got to be a letter. So you want to say it begins with a P, ends with T. You could decide if upper or lower case are equally acceptable, and has three probably letters in between. And the shame of it is that this does not exist, because this is at least as useful as talking about the square root of minus one, which doesn't exist and isn't an imaginary number. So we know a lot of mathematics we don't need, but we don't have notation for other things that we might need. And that'll be sort of a lead-in to the notation we're going to use, because we'll use it to define scanners. So that's a good break. We'll do it about 10 minutes. 15 minutes turned out to be too long last semester. So we'll see you in about 10 minutes, about 20 of. We'll do another hour session and then a final half-hour session.